It's March the 20th, and hello, this is a Science Set Free podcast with myself, Mark Vernon, and Rupert Sheldrake. Rupert, I thought we should talk about silence and get over the business about talking about something that is not about talking. But it seems to me that it's one of these things that's happening in our culture at the moment, the desire for silence. It seems to be growing. You think of mindfulness movements, quiet gardens, all sorts of things. And it feels to me as if we've realised that without silence, we lose touch with a side of experience that traditionally has been connected with spiritual or religious practice, but that in a world full of noise and distraction is thinning our humanity. And I thought that it might be, you know, something which we could explore together. And what is it, particularly, I suppose, what interests me is what is it that silence gives us or helps us to discover or unfolds that without a practice of silence, you miss out on, almost like a sort of vertical dimension of human experience. Does this make sort of broad sense to you?
Yes. I suppose it's a quantitative question, isn't it? Because all sound involves silence. You know, when we're speaking between sentences, there's a short period of silence when you take a new breath. And so there's a sense in which, and even music, there's, you know, the nature of sound and pitch is sound and silence, like you have the beats and the gaps between them. So it's really expanding the gaps between things, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's a really important point because actually practice of silence aren't completely silent, but what they are using maybe chant, maybe breathing, and then, you know, in things like music and in poetry, which of course has a kind of silence to it, it's intentionally trying to expose oneself to behold, to receive what the silence within the music or the silence within the poetry is conveying. So I think actually, you know, we're talking about silence, but the paradox is that, in a way, in our talk, we're trying to convey something of what lies beyond the words. And there's this strange thing that you need the words, you need the music, you need the breath, in order to be open to the silence that is not actually a literal no noise, of which, you know, doesn't really exist. But it is trying to open oneself to a kind of metaphorical meaning of silence that, again, in religious traditions has been associated with the divine. In spiritual traditions has been associated with, you know, maybe the divine compassion or the ground of being, various kind of words given to it.
Yes. I suppose when we are in silence, say you sit quietly meditating, then what happens in the silence is that one becomes aware of the non-silence within oneself. You know, anyone who's tried meditating knows that there's a constant stream of distracting thoughts. And so those become more apparent, that within the silence we become more aware of the non-silence within ourselves. I think a lot of the things about the modern world is it crowds out silence to avoid that awareness of what's going on inside oneself. I mean, the fact that a lot of people have music on in the background the whole time, and you know, hotels and things often have muzak in the background because they don't want to have silence.
Yes, in a way, the opposite of silence is not noise, it's distraction or something
yes,
like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a great many distractions in the modern world, and now with social media, the fact that you see people sitting around on buses and things, that very few of them are just silently looking out of the window, or they're sending text messages or listening to things on through earphones and stuff. There's a way in which modern lives are filled with ever greater levels of busyness, being busy all the time. It's enormously distracting.
Yeah, and I think when you talk of it like that, what it says to me is that silence is actually a kind of a practice that is about how you perceive the world. And in particular, it's about tuning in to that which is implicit or is invisible, but nonetheless is crucial to how we experience the world. I mean, for example, I was reading something the other day that was talking about crows and how crows use tools, and they're very advanced tool users in the animal world. But of course, the crow doesn't think of the stick that it's using to get ants out of a log as a tool. That is a concept. It's only, as so far as we know, we human beings that have concepts and will think of the stick as a tool. In a way, we bring that silent thing, the concept of tool, to our sticks. And that enables us to not just use tools like crows do, but to massively expand our ability to use tools, to ornate our tools. You know, we don't just use sticks, we use carved sticks, which we then regard as being aesthetically beautiful. We can then sell sticks. They can have attached value to them. And the argument, which I found very persuasive, was that all this invisible stuff that attaches to a stick, it's kind of silent, you might say, around the stick, but makes for so much of what is part of our human experience, that things have aesthetic value, that things have financial value, and that we have the imaginative capacity to develop and evolve new ways of using, in this example, sticks, that makes, you know, for the vast richness of the human environment. And it's all this kind of, it's a kind of silent notion around this materiality, that which is actually immaterial or invisible. In this case, you know, a kind of conceptual notion like tools.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's related to thinking, isn't it? Thinking, one can think silently. And in fact, it's easier to think in silence. I mean, I spend quite a lot of time just thinking. And I find it easiest to do when I'm, say, on Hampstead Heath or walking or in a silent room. I find it much harder to do if there's radio or TV going on somewhere, or if there's music, because the music draws me in, or if there's chatter or noise all around. I find it easier to think in silence. But that's the external silence is no longer taking me away from the internal activity. And that internal activity of thought, in a sense, is the ground of this silent world that surrounds objects. I mean, every invention, every new tool, every new discovery has had to be thought up. And that thinking would happen in external silence, but not internal silence, as it were.
So this raises the very interesting question as to what the silence gives you that you couldn't have in, you know, a more noisy or didactic kind of exchange. And one idea, which again I found very persuasive, has been put together by a chap called Ian McGilchrist, whose book came out 2 or 3 years ago now, called The Master and His Emissary.
Yes,
we may have mentioned this before, but it's a very powerful book, I think, and it could be regarded as a kind of nascent silence of science of silence, because what he argues in the book is that we broadly have two perceptual systems, and one is the kind of perceptual system that focuses, that can manipulate, that you know, can take and can develop in a very programmatic kind of way. And when we know what goals we have in mind and more or less how to get there, it uses maps, which are kind of contractions of reality, but very useful ways of getting through, you know, a city or a town, in terms of using a literal map. But he says that's only one way of perceiving and engaging with the world. And there's another way, which particularly neuroscience is helping to explore, which he uses in the book. And that is a much more open kind of way, where, as it were, we don't go to the world with our preconceived ideas, but we try and open to the world to allow the world to impact upon us. And in this book, it became clear to me that that's part of what a practice of silence can give you. That it's a completely different perceptual way of engaging with the world, that steps into uncertainty, into that which is known, which moves to the edge of, perhaps in your case, the edge of what you know you're thinking at the moment, and makes for a new thought to arise. Quite from where, it's hard to say, but nonetheless, it seems to be very much part of creative thinking.
Yes. I think it's not just allowing thoughts to come in from silence, it's also opening to the other senses. Like, for example, when I go walking on Hampstead Heath, if I'm walking with somebody and we're talking, I notice much less about the heath than if I'm walking on my own silently. You know, I'm interested in plants, so I notice the plants much more and the views and things. if I go to an art gallery and I'm with somebody who's talking and we're discussing all the pictures and that sort of thing, it's I don't see them as well because I'm so bound up in words then. And if I go to, say, choral evensong at Westminster Abbey, if I arrive early and I'm sitting there quietly before the service begins, I'm looking round at the Gothic arches and the vaulting and the ceiling and the stained glass windows and that sort of thing. But as soon as the music and the service begin, the words and the sounds draw me in and I'm less open to the visual. So I think silence can help to free one up both to inner thoughts and also to visual and other stimuli, including smells.
Yeah, so it's it expands one's experience as well as one's thoughts or thinking.
Yes.
And one's cognitive capacities and so on. You mentioned Westminster Abbey there, and I think that one of the things which is very difficult in Western, certainly Christianity, is that silence is not really part, certainly, of liturgies that you find in a parish church anyway very much. And I think this is a huge loss because I think it's only in silence that one really can find a sort of sustained perception of the divine, of a kind of underpinning life that one can only really come into sustained contact with if one can let go of the hubbub of the everyday thoughts. Yes. That tend to preoccupy us. You know, another way of putting it is saying that we tend to get rather caught up in our own self concerns, our self-consciousness, and one of the things that silence can do is, first of all, you know, as you were saying, make us realise quite how much our minds are full of this stuff. But the next step is realise that it's possible to sort of ease off from it slightly, to take a step back. And when that happens, a new awareness of a deeper kind of experience that's not our own comes through, which I think in spiritual traditions is associated with the divine. I think, you know, we all get glimpses of this deeper awareness, you know, when we have a slightly sort of peaked experience of things, or maybe at the end of a wonderful piece of music, there's that pause before the clapping begins, and it feels like in that pause you get a glimpse of something more tremendous even than the music itself. I think silent practices, I've been very persuaded by this, that silent practices are so important because it's about developing a more sustained capacity to stay in touch with this awareness, or the ground of being, the cloud of unknowing, as is put in one of the famous Christian classics on this subject. And I just wonder whether, you know, practices of silence, which seem to be popular in our times, are partly therapeutic, you know, helping people step back from the hubbub, but maybe also are implicitly putting people in touch with a sense of being that is deeper than our own rather isolated notions that we normally play to.
Well, I think so. And I think there are several ways in which people can, or at least I can, find myself in silence. One is by walking in the countryside or Hampstead Heath, or I like walking. And of course, in streets, there's a lot going on. But if you're walking in the countryside, the countryside is probably more silent and less distracting than it's ever been before. In India, which I've recently been in India, and if you walk in the countryside in India, there's people everywhere. There are small fields and there are people there. If you walk through, someone pops up and says, you know, it says hello and greets you, and they're perfectly friendly and stuff, but terribly hard to be alone in India. Whereas in England or in the US or most of Europe, agriculture is now involves so few people that you have, you know, one person can look after 1,000 acres. So you walk through fields in the countryside and most of the time it's completely deserted. It's probably a relatively new experience to be able to walk through farmed countryside in silence and to be alone and as a space in silence. People have always had this by going to mountains and caves, and in India, holy men of and holy women have gone up to caves in the Himalayas and retired to forests and so on. And Jesus used to go and meditate in the hills, and you know, going up onto the hills into wild places, and the Jewish prophets used to go into the wilderness. And so there's always been ways of doing it through getting away from people into wilder places. But one of the ways in which I think churches provide a basis for silence is not in services, because, as you say, they're generally they're pretty busy, one thing after another. But when they're not services going on, many Anglican and Roman Catholic churches are open during the daytime, and many English village churches are open in the day. Many urban churches are, and cathedrals. And you can go in, and it's kind of amazing oasis of quiet. Particularly in New York, I have this experience. I've found out where many of the churches are in New York, Episcopalian and Catholic churches. Most of them are open all day. And there you've got these incredibly intense, busy streets. And you can walk into one of these churches, and suddenly there's this amazing calm and quiet. And many of them have candles. You can light a candle and say a prayer, and then you can just sit there quietly. I find them wonderful places to be quiet in, partly because the atmosphere is one that's conducive to quietness and stillness and a more contemplative mood.
Yeah, and what strikes me about that kind of experience, which I know myself as well, is that, again, it's not just silence. Maybe a more correct word is stillness, and that stillness allows and opens up a perception of a kind of deeper pulse of life, which is preserved in these places. Maybe what, you know, Christians and the Stoics before them called the logos, this notion of a kind of benign pull or tendency that underpins all things, and that a kind of stillness can enable you to move from the sort of surface turmoil of the everyday and sink to a slightly different level of being.
Yes.
And so experience, you know, when you sit for a moment in a church. I mean, I actually go for a more sustained silence with others to the Buddhist Society, which is a place behind Victoria Station in London. And in the room where we sit for our sessions, there are a couple of Buddhist statues of the Buddha. And people use these statues in different ways, but I like to do a bow to them. And part of what's going on for me in that bow at the beginning of my silence is kind of saying, you know, you're still here, this deeper pulse and everything. And my intention is to try and drop away from whatever's disturbing me at that particular time. To be more receptive to that deeper pulse of things.
Mm.
And just a little bow, setting that intention, and then doing the stillness, the sitting. It all feels part of this opening up, which I think can be found.
And I suppose the ultimate sense in which we experience silence is when we're in deep sleep. Because every one of us, every day, has a period of silence. I mean, there may be noises going on around us, but we're unaware of them when we're in deep sleep. And so deep sleep is a state of mind where we're unconscious, but we are dipping into that deep silence, which actually is necessary for our being. People who are sleep deprived go insane if it goes on long enough. It's a form of torture, sleep deprivation. And, you know, some people can do with less sleep than others, but practically everyone needs to sleep. And I think that our entire conscious life depends on this wave of going from awareness to sleep and ultimate silence, and then back to awareness and back to sleep. That it's somehow the nature of consciousness is to have this intermittent total silence as part of its very being.
Mm. That's very interesting. I hadn't thought of sleep and silence. I mean, it makes me wonder whether part of what happens in sleep too is that we relax, let go of this, self-concerns, self-obsessions. It's a very vulnerable thing to do, to sleep, you want to go to sleep in a safe place. But maybe that's part of the relief of the refreshment of sleep, that sort of self-holding, you might say, that goes on for a lot of the day, which again you are encouraged to sort of let go of in silent practices when you're awake. But maybe that's part of the benefit of sleep too, actually. I hadn't thought of it like that.
Well, and you know, the Tibetans say that deep sleep is one of the four the states of consciousness, turiya. It's a state of consciousness. We're not normally aware of it, but one of the advanced practices is to become aware when you're in deep sleep, and then you're in a kind of cosmic consciousness. That deep sleep is when we lose all sense of personal identity, differentiation, normal separation, etc. And there's a sense in which all of us are participating in a total state of undifferentiated interconnectedness in deep sleep, of the ultimate state of united consciousness, except we're unconscious of it. And one of their practices is to become conscious in sleep. And then it is this kind of ultimate unifying consciousness. We all have it every day or every night without realizing it. And there's a sense in which when we're awake, it may be that these practices of silence or meditation are ways of connecting with something that we already have unconsciously and take for granted.
I don't know if this is the same thing, but when you were talking, it made me think about how wisdom traditions more generally seem to all have in common this idea that true wisdom comes not just from the head, but also from the heart, a kind of engagement between these two receptive sorting kind of capacities that we have. And again, it seems to me that silence cultivates the heart side of things, because it feels to me like it is a more receptive, more connecting, less controlling kind of facility way of engaging with the world. And when you were talking about that Tibetan practice of sleep, it just made me wonder whether perhaps there's a kind of intermittent stage which comes about from moving into the body in silent practices, moving particularly to the heart, the kind of abdomen area. Because that does, I think, often feel like maybe a state of consciousness that is alert, but is different from the more possessing, focusing, doing kind of consciousness of the everyday. Perhaps it's somewhere in between deep sleep and normal waking consciousness.
Yes. Well, I mean, the heart and the breathing are, although we associate them with stillness in some way, they're not still. I mean, the heart, by its very nature, if you're alive, is beating and is in ceaseless activity, even when you're asleep, and the breathing too. I mean, you're breathing. I think one of the ways that there's a sense in which, for most of the time, and if we're not in pain, much of our body is silent. We're not consciously aware of what's going on in our guts. There's a lot of activity, peristalsis, movement of stuff through tubes inside us. There's lots of things going on, blood circulating, white blood cells moving around the place, and red blood cells and whatnot. I mean, there's a huge amount of activity going on in our bodies all the time, of which we're completely unaware. I think one of the reasons that meditation and pranayama, yogic breathing practice, work in the way they do is that breathing is a kind of interface between the automatic and normally silent activity of our bodies, unconscious activity of our bodies, which goes on anyway when we're asleep, and our conscious minds, because most of us can't deliberately change our heartbeat, but we can deliberately change our breathing rate. And we can hold our breath, we can take longer or shorter breaths, breathing practices in this yogic breathing in these systems like pranayama involve actually consciously controlling the breathing. And I think through doing that, I think that's one of the ways in which the conscious mind is linked to the unconscious and otherwise silent and unaware unconscious activity of our bodies, the rest of our bodies. So the breathing can act as a bridge, because it's on this interface between the conscious and the unconscious.
Yeah, and the work that Ian McGilchrist draws together in this book resonates with that, because he talks about how the right-hand hemisphere of the brain, which he associates more with this receptive kind of perception, I understand that it's a kind of neurological fact that it has many, many more neurological connections to the body than the left-hand hemisphere of the brain. And moreover, it seems there are sort of more neurons connecting it than are required to do these automatic functions. And he speculates in the book that that's perhaps because, well, these are my words now, but as I remember it, that the body is this sort of transitional, amongst other things the body does for us, it can become this sort of transitional space between consciousness and unconsciousness, and that by paying attention to things like breathing or doing body scans, as we often do in meditation, it's not just because suddenly you realise that you can feel, you know, the second toe on your right foot that you've never felt before, But that itself is a sort of stepping stone into experiencing something which has been unconscious before.
Mm.
I wonder whether you think that... I'm going to cut it there, actually. But I can edit this out. Well, I suppose the good thing about silence is that, or stillness, as we've perhaps concluded more than it is that it's something everyone can try. And in fact, I think if you don't have much silence or stillness, even a little bit, can be really quite surprising. It can have really quite a big impact. Certainly in my experience, then developing that capacity is, you know, an ongoing process. But it has been one, I guess I'd say over a period of, you know, years, I feel has, you know, really quite transformed my perception of things. And certainly for my own returning to Christianity and belief in God, having this sort of sustained sense of underpinning that has come about through a silent practice has been really absolutely crucial to that, actually.
Yes. Well, I think a silent practice of some kind or other is found probably all over the world in all traditions, and it is, you know, one of the basic aspects of our consciousness. In the modern world, often crowded out, but I think everyone must experience it at some time or another, and doing it deliberately and consciously is one of the simplest and certainly the cheapest ways of expanding one's spiritual awareness.
It is one of the common practices. In fact, I read the other day that the phrase navel gazing actually comes from the early Christian monks who would sit contemplating, and people said, what are they doing navel gazing all day long? But you know, we need perhaps to learn from those navel gazers and rediscover this practice for ourselves. Thanks very much.
Thank you.